find out who we are. We look up to the sky to find out who we are. We embark on this ride to find out who we are. We look up to the sky to realize.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. Sort of we're going to have a kind of a short pre-Thanksgiving break episode of the Weekly Stuff Podcast because a lot of stuff going on, not a ton to talk about today. We had an episode of Doctor Who, which was finally good this week.
Yay! Good Doctor Who.
Not the best episode ever, but It was good. It was an episode. It had an idea and a theme and story. It was good.
This is the first episode of Doctor Who from this season that I'm looking forward to watching again at some point in the future.
I think that's a good way to put it, and we will talk about that. So luckily, this episode, unlike the last five, will not end on us despairing about the future of our favorite TV show.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far yet, but we will have a positive discussion about an episode of Doctor Who. It's been a while since we did that.
It has been a while, and that's been sad. We'll talk about that. We'll talk a little bit more Red Dead 2, although as Sean has not finished the story yet, we're not going to do a ton this week because I think we've exhausted most of our spoiler-free impression stuff we can do.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the game Tetris Effect, which is fucking awesome.
Cool.
And I've got some other stories. But Sean, let's just start with some stuff. We'll get to Red Dead 2 in a little bit, but what have you been up to?
Oh, just Red Dead 2. That's
just
it.
Red Dead 2?
That's okay. It. Yeah, I don't think I've done anything else. I'm reading Moby Dick. I don't know. Do we want to talk about that?
I can't. What do you have to say about Moby Dick?
Moby Dick's a really good. It's a good book.
Okay.
That guy Herman Melville. He wrote a good one. Moby Dick is a way weirder book than I think the popular conception about it is, because everybody knows Moby Dick as that book where the crazy dude hunts the big whale and the first line is "Call me Ishmael," and that's all that anybody knows about Moby Dick that hasn't read Moby Dick. And Moby Dick is actually a book that's mostly about Herman Melville, the author, just going on long, strange rants about his opinions on whaling and whales and America, and just it's. There are parts where that book literally becomes a play, by which I mean that all of a sudden it's like you're reading a script of like a Shakespearean play. There are parts where he just completely breaks narrative convention and you're just given access to information that Ishmael, the narrator, would never have access to, and he never addresses it. It is a weird fucking book. And so if you have just been sitting there and saying, I'm never going to read Moby Dick because it sounds like it's boring, like just like classic novel, Moby Dick's fucking weird as shit. You should probably read it if you want to.
Nice. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I wasn't planning on giving a big Moby Dick speech, but there it is.
This has been Sean's Literary Corner.
Yes. Oh, also one other thing about Moby Dick. That novel is super gay. Like, it is unbelievably gay. It's not subtext. Like, literally Ishmael marries Queequeg. That's not like there's a subtext about those two characters marrying. They literally use the word marriage to refer to like how they bond and have a partnership together after their first meeting in the novel, wherein they sleep in the same bed together and Queequeg spoons Ishmael. Like, that's not, again, that's not subtext. That's not me reading into it as a modern reading. It is super gay, and it is amazing to me to think about the, like, 100+ years of literary criticism that exists and, like, schooling and stuff that happened, that aspect of the novel had to be completely ignored because nobody could read homosexuality into anything. And then now you look at it and you're like, it's impossible to read Moby Dick and not address the fact that Herman Melville was 100% gay, and this novel is super gay, and it's great.
How in the year 2018 do we not have the super gay film adaptation of Moby Dick that just does all of that?
Yeah, that's
that makes
what we
me
need.
Sad. You could get that made today.
Yes, we need super gay Moby Dick, and just call the movie that too, so people know going in. It's like you're getting the real shit this time.
That can be the tagline on the poster.
Yeah, you're getting the real shit.
this time. Okay. Well, anyway, that was a weird start to the podcast. I didn't know we were going to go there.
Neither
Moby
did
Dick
I.
In general, or the gayness of Moby Dick, which I, Sean, I am one of those people. All I know is it's about whaling, and the first line is "Call me Ishmael." So
yep.
I am one of those people. Maybe I will read it someday. Anyway, what have I been up to? I have a story to tell.
Cool.
I went on an adventure yesterday to the state of Illinois, which is next to the state of Iowa. I went to see a concert. One of my favorite musical artists of all time, Little Steven, Stevie Van Zandt. He is one of the guitarists in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, but he is also a really amazing songwriter and solo artist. And I have been listening to his albums almost as long as I've been listening to Bruce Springsteen stuff, which we don't talk about music a lot on this show, but if you know anything about my musical tastes, you know that's who I am. Mm-hmm. And I've been wanting to see, you know, Little Steven play a concert forever, but he has not toured in 20 years until last year, started up again. He and his band, The Disciples of Soul, and they had a show last night in Peoria, Illinois. I did not know what Peoria, Illinois was, but I found that they were going to be playing there, and it was only 2 hours from my house, so I'm like, I can do that. 2 hour drive, go see one of my favorite artists. This sounds fun. So I did that. It was a great concert, and I'll talk about that in a second. The adventure part of the story is that the 2 hour drive took about 3.5 because pretty much everything that could go wrong short of me not getting there went wrong on the way to me doing this very simple 2 hour drive to Illinois.
Okay.
The drive through Iowa was fine. And then I get over the Illinois state line and almost immediately I get pulled over by a fucking cop. And what had happened, I didn't even really notice it. I don't think I actually did this, but whatever. These litigious motherfuckers in Illinois gave me a ticket for not pulling over to the left when he had pulled someone else over. And you're supposed to, like, pull into the other lane so you don't drive by the cop car. Now, I did not know that was law. I know that's something you're supposed to do as, like, conduct.
Yeah,
but
yeah, I'm with you. I didn't realize that was a legal issue. That just feels like that's just like the normal courtesy of what you do driving.
Yeah. So anyway, motherfucker, you want to know how much a traffic ticket costs in Illinois?
How much?
$120.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's more than I spent on everything else this concert related. The ticket was $40. It took me like half a tank of gas fill up to get there. 120 fucking anyway. If I want to fight it, you know where the courthouse is that I have to go? To fucking Illinois. So I'm really fucked on this one. He also gave me a ticket for not having proof of insurance, which I did have, except motherfuckers at Progressive, I'm just angry right now and I'm calling people out. They don't send you ID cards anymore. They put it on an app, like everyone does. And the app I couldn't get into because the login wasn't working. And the guy didn't give me the time to figure it out. And so he slapped me with that, and I can get out of that $120 ticket if I'm able to provide that proof of insurance, which I can. Once I got home, I found it and it was fine. But anyway, it's just a point of conduct to everybody in our audience. If you drive a car and your stupid insurance company does not send you physical insurance cards anymore, print them out and like put them in your car. Do not trust on your phone for that because it's going to let you down. That was my bummer ride, and I don't know how I'm going to figure that out. If I actually have to drive to a fucking Illinois courthouse to figure all this out, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know. I might go wander off into the desert somewhere and never come back.
It's like the most benign reason for becoming like a career criminal. It's just like, fuck it, I got to go off the grid, man. You start selling fucking meth like it's Breaking Bad. You break bad because of this one traffic offense.
No, I mean, look, there are moments in life where you see the logic of libertarianism, because most days it sounds like a bunch of fucking crazy people, but then you get a traffic ticket for nothing, and it's like, here, pay us $300 and drive to a courthouse in Illinois, and I'm like, yeah, you know what, you should not be able to do this, this is fucking stupid, and I don't want us to have driver's licenses or registration or any of that anymore, I want total anarchy, Gary Johnson 2020. I'm kidding. No, please don't anyone like sound clip me on that, put that out there.
Yeah, it's Jonathan's political views have completely flipped on their head.
Yes.
Because of one very dumb encounter with the police.
Apparently this is what Illinois is like, though. I learned this, my brother was telling me this. They're famous for they have some of the worst traffic in the country, like traffic accidents and stuff, so their police officers are very litigious. So anyway, and it was, I mean, it was like right after I got over the Illinois state line, too. Anyway.
I just like to think that you have those Illinois cops, like, right on that border between Iowa and Illinois, waiting for those damn Iowans coming over, bringing their Iowa bullshit into Illinois. You gotta stop them.
Iowa's great. We're fine. I don't ever see cops in Iowa. You know?
That's the problem from the Illinois point of view. No fucking cops over there. They're just a bunch of crazies.
All right. So anyway, I get done with that. You know, if you've ever been pulled over by a cop, this is only the second time in my life, but if you've ever been pulled over, you know it takes a while. So that added like a half hour onto my trip. And then I pulled over again, like when I got to a rest area, just to kind of decompress because I was angry about that and I wanted to read like the text of the ticket and figure shit out about that. I had plenty of time. I was trying to get to the concert early. So I get done doing all that. I'm decompressed and I pull back out on the highway. And I'm driving, you know, when you're driving down a highway for long distances like that, you use cruise control. So I had my cruise control on, I'm sailing down the road, and suddenly my cruise control off and all the lights on my dash start flashing, and I'm like, what the fuck happened? And I pull over to figure this out, and now I have three lights on my dashboard, the check engine light, the traction control, and my cruise control light is flashing, and I don't know what is happening, but I cannot use cruise control anymore. Which sucks when you're on a multi-hour drive out in the country.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, what the hell is going on? I can't figure it out. I'm looking desperately through my, owner's manual to try to figure out all these lights. But those owner's manuals just are not helpful. They are not laid out in a way that is supposed to be helpful. So I call my brother, because I'm driving. I can't do much with this other than, like, pulling over, and I have to get somewhere. So I call him, and I say, this light, and this light is on. Can you look that up on the computer and be like, call me back and see what it is? And he called me back, and he had a theory about the issue, and we tried some different troubleshooting but never figured it out. I'm going to have to take the car into a mechanic. Like, everything else with the car is fine, but I cannot use cruise control at the moment, and the check engine light is on. It's a Subaru Outback. If anyone has had that issue and knows what's going on, I can crowdsource this one. So that was weird, and I had to do the entire two-hour drive back after the concert without cruise control, which, when you've been on your feet for 3 hours at a show, and your feet really hurt after that, and you'd really like to take your foot off the pedal when it's like 1 a.m. and you're driving through the night, it sucks to not have cruise control and a bunch of lights flashing on your dashboard. And I forgot the weirdest part of all this, Sean, which is that as day was turning into night, because we just had daylight savings time, so like sunset is like 4:30 around here my time, which is bad. I want the sun to set later. Anyway, I realized, oh shit, one of my headlights is out. And I realized that just as I pulled away from the cop. And I'm like, I'm so fucked. Everything is fucked. But you know what happened when all the other lights on my dashboard went out, Sean, and the cruise control went away?
Uh-huh.
The headlight came back on.
Nice.
So I got that. I got the headlight back on. It's fine.
It's like one of those like space sim games where it's like you diverted power from the cruise control system back into the headlight system. So your headlights turned back on, but you can't use cruise control anymore.
I don't know what's going on. I have bad luck with cars. I don't know. But anyway, all of that aside, I finally got to go to the concert. And it was so great. You know, if you've ever seen a Bruce Springsteen show or just any really super popular artist, you know, those are usually in like a stadium or a sports arena and it's really big and there's like tens of thousands of people in attendance. This was not that. It was a little kind of almost like a club in Peoria, very small, intimate venue. And it was not a particularly well-attended show, which meant that I got to just go right up to the stage. And I was, like, right up against the stage for this entire show with one of my musical heroes, and that was so cool. He has put together a fantastic band. It is a 15-piece, you know, rock and roll, souls, blues band with backup dancers and singers and a 5-piece horn section and a percussionist and all this other stuff. It's so cool. Amazing show. The lineup of songs he has is just, it's like the perfect concert set list. You can actually hear the basic set list I heard. There's an album called Soulfire Live that you can get on like Spotify and Apple Music. And it's the basic show that he and his band are playing right now. And I would highly recommend it. It's just amazing music. He's playing a lot of his originals from over the years, a couple of, you know, blues and souls covers. And it just a fantastic show, one of the best nights of my life. You know, I don't talk about music on here much because this is not a music podcast, but, you know, music is very important to me, and This is someone I've been listening to since I was like 17 and I had my first summer job and I had discovered his first album, Men Without Women, and I was listening to it. And back then that album was out of print. He's gotten it back into print. So I had to like go find it at an old record store and I was just listening to it every day at work. It was the best. And hearing so many of those songs live, it was really cool. Amazing band. Worth the absolute shit I went through to get there and then to get back. Now I've got to deal with all this in a very big, because now this is the other thing is that next week is Thanksgiving and I'm planning on driving back to Colorado. So I've got to get my car checked out and figure out what the hell's going on with that. I got to deal with this fucking litigious bullshit. You can see I'm holding up the stupid tickets that motherfucker gave me. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this publicly before I have like a court date with all this, but I don't care.
Fuck yeah, you're fine. They don't have podcasts in Illinois. You know, that technology hasn't gotten that far.
Yeah, those pig fuckers don't have shit yet.
Okay. Okay, I wasn't going to go that far. I was keeping it above a certain level.
Land of Lincoln. Lincoln, Obama. That's it. It's all they've given us.
Okay, yeah.
I'm mad at you, Illinois.
I look forward to when you come back down to Colorado, you getting a Colorado ticket as well. Right on your way back to Iowa, and so then you're in Iowa and you have to deal with an Illinois ticket and a Colorado ticket while you're living in
Sean,
Iowa.
Have you ever been in eastern Colorado? They don't have civilization out there yet, let alone cops.
It's very true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that whole story you're telling, it sounds like the concert was awesome, but everything around that is the reason why I don't ever go outside. And the reason why, while you were dealing with all of that, I was just at home reading my super gay Moby Dick and just having a great time. And you were getting harassed by an Illinois police officer.
I don't know, man. It was, you know, it's weird. When you go, as Bilbo Baggins said to Frodo, you know, you never know what happens when you step foot outside your door. It's crazy.
Yep, it's just the whole world bullshit out there.
That's what Bilbo Baggins said to Frodo.
Yep, it's a whole...
Frodo, my lad, whole world of bullshit out there.
It's like, you think you do three solid movies and you're done, and then they just say, nope, we're going to make three more. And it's like, probably shouldn't have gone that far. World of bullshit.
The Hobbit trilogy would have been so better if it ended with Bilbo getting back home and time-lapse him into old Bilbo, and he walks up to Elijah Wood and says, Frodo, my lad, there's a whole world of bullshit out there. And then just cut to black. Yeah. All right. Anyway, I've been doing some other stuff. I'm pretty much done with Red Dead Redemption 2. I've got a little more of the end game stuff left. I might put it aside for a little while. I've played a lot of that game, but I did finish the main story, and we'll talk about that in a little bit because I have thoughts. But I did get a new video game, and this is a game, it was announced at E3 this year. It kind of flew under the radar for me until critics and journalists started talking about it last week, and there was a demo. And, oh boy, Sean, if ever a game was made for me, it is Tetris Effect for the PlayStation 4. Have you heard about this, Sean?
Yes, it is actually something of... It reminded me that we never talked about the E3 trailer for this game, because that trailer, I think, came out the last day of E3, so we missed it when we did our E3 wrap-up. But that is maybe one of the best trailers for any video game ever. That is just this guy giving a slow narration about what Tetris Effect is, which is when you the perceived scientific research phenomena of people playing Tetris so much that then they see Tetris shapes in their life, and like when they're like you zone out and they're like all of a sudden you just see blocks falling and moving in like actual real world space. And so it's like that guy delivering that speech and then it transitioning into the song "I'm Yours Forever" or whatever from the game. And yeah, so that trailer is amazing. People who haven't seen that trailer should check that trailer out. But yes, this is a game that I have been interested in that has come out at the worst possible time for me because Hitman 2 comes out in 2 days. Yes. So, and I'm not done with Red Dead 2 yet.
No, I know. When you have a chance, you should pick it up, though, Sean. Tetris Effect is amazing. It's a new version of Tetris. It's kind of hard to explain without like you looking at a video or actually just playing it for yourself. But I will do my best. Tetris Effect is, it's by, I think his name's Tetsuya Mizuguchi, who is a game developer who has made some very famous rhythm games, things like, I think Lumines is his.
Yeah, Lumines, as it is actually pronounced.
Lumines and Rez. He did Rez, right?
Yeah, Rez is the Miz's big game that people probably have heard of.
Yeah, and Tetris Effect is like his like lifelong passion project he's wanted to do, which is take all of that skill he has for rhythm and very synesthesia-based games, which is to say, like trying to combine a lot of visual and auditory sensations into a video game atmosphere, but apply that to Tetris. And so what Tetris Effect is what you play is basically just Tetris. They have not fundamentally altered anything about the underlying form of Tetris. Like, at its core, this game is just a very rock-solid version of the Tetris we all know and love. They have not really fucked with it in any way. But around the game board are these amazing 3D cinematic, atmospheric, it's really hard to explain, sort of visual symphonies going on in tandem with really interesting electronic music. It's an all-original score. They did not go out and license music. This is music that was written and performed for this game. And as you play the game, all of what you do in Tetris, which again is the basic stuff, you move your pieces, you can turn them one way or the other, you can hold, all of that is synced to different sound elements in the music. So you are creating rhythm in the song, and as your game in Tetris goes along, the song becomes bigger and bigger, and the visuals, which are also sort of synced with the music, also get bigger and more kind of all-encompassing. And that is the basic sales pitch of what this game does. And on a basic level, like, from a mechanical standpoint, I think Tetris Effect provides, like, kind of a fascinating case study for lack of a better term, like video game theory, like academic game theory, which would be like, what is a video game actually? Because from a fundamental mechanical standpoint, this is just Tetris. They've added in the story mode, journey mode is what they call it, there's a little thing you can do where you can enter the zone, a la Dragon Quest XI. Isn't that what they call it in Japanese?
Yes, yeah, you get into the zone, yeah.
Yeah, in English it's pepped up. So you get pepped up in Tetris Effect. And, you know, you enter the zone and you can basically place down a bunch of pieces and get a bunch of lines cleared at once. It's an interesting little thing. Again, does not fundamentally alter the mechanics. And in the other, you know, you can play the game completely straight if you want. But mechanically, it's just Tetris. And it's everything that's happening around you as the player that makes this a special experience. So it really is this interesting question for me of, like, what is the game? What makes this game special? Because this is a special game. I'm not the only one saying this. I'm pretty sure that if you play Tetris Effect, you are legally required to go out and describe it as a religious experience, which is what I'm going to do. It kind of is. But it is this exercise in what atmosphere and aesthetics do to the video game experience and how much this interactive medium, I think, can be colored by these synesthetic elements of music and sound and the vibration of the controller and all these things going on as you play the game. So you play Tetris and this amazing music is playing and these amazing visuals are all around your vision around the board, and what you are doing in the game is so just tactily and orally connected to everything you are feeling and hearing and seeing. And it is this crazy, amazing, synesthetic experience. And it is truly pretty emotional at a certain point to be playing this amazing puzzle game and have this really overwhelming aesthetic thing surrounding it. And it is fascinating. It is singular. There has never been anything like it. And I don't talk about this much on the podcast, my love of Tetris, but I am an avid Tetris player. I probably play Tetris every day of my life in one form or another. Usually, my preferred version, because I'm picky about it, is still the Game Boy Color version, Tetris DX, which I just have an emulator on my computer. And then sometimes I've got my Game Boy Advance SP around here somewhere. I think that's the cartridge that is still in it most days, if I'm ever using it. And that's the version, like, if I really want to seriously play some Tetris, I play. But I loved Puyo Puyo Tetris last year. All the iPhone versions are shit. EA never figured out how to do Tetris on iPhone, which was too bad. But I have, like, not bought a new version of Tetris outside Puyo Puyo Tetris in a while. But, like, Tetris is, like, one of the few games I would, hopefully without ego, describe myself as I'm actually good at it. Like, that's a game I'm probably better than the average player at Tetris, because I have just spent a lot of time in my life playing it. It is, like, soothing. It really activates your brain. You can both zone out and concentrate deeply. It's the kind of game where I do my best at it when I am not consciously thinking about it. Like, to do really well at Tetris on higher speeds, you cannot be, like, consciously choosing, like, this goes there. You just have to be feeling it. And you know, so Tetris Effect is one of the few games in my life I ever started the story mode and boosted up the difficulty as high as it would go. I went to expert mode right away. It gets very hard. It was very enjoyable, though, and engaging. Unless you're a Tetris expert, I would not recommend that because it could take away from a lot of the other experiential stuff. Like, you should save that for a second or third playthrough. The normal mode is very well calibrated. I'm going back and playing that to get some higher ranks. But, again, as a longtime Tetris player and someone who, again, plays this game like every day, playing it in this way where you are asked to completely give yourself over to the game. Because that's the other thing. Tetris is a game you play while doing other things, like listening to podcasts or traveling or hanging out at a bus stop or something like that. It's an in-between game. Tetris Effect asks you to give it your full attention. It is best when you put on a nice pair of headphones and you turn the lights off and you look at your TV, because this is only on PS4. You can't take this on the go. It's not a Switch game or something like that. And it probably shouldn't be. I don't think that would be the best medium for this game. And you are just there with the game, playing it, pouring yourself into it as this aesthetic experience. It's really special. We have had some great AAA video games this year, but I would wager there's no game from 2018 that people will be talking about in hushed tones as a cult classic as much as Tetris Effect. I think that's like a Rez or something. Like, in 20 years, people are going to be talking about Tetris Effect as like, oh, that thing we got to play on the PS4 back in the day, that was fucking special. And it is. It also does have a PSVR mode, and I am sure that is really cool. I do not own a PSVR. This is the first game that makes me want a PSVR. Not enough that I could go spend the money I don't have, especially after fucking Illinois people. So I'm not going to go get a PSVR setup, but I would love to play this that way. My understanding is that the board stays in the center of your vision, but those surrounding visuals just literally go 360 around you and are in 3D, and that would be really, really cool. But either way, it is perfectly fine on a normal PS4 or the PS4 Pro. I fucking love this game, Sean.
Yeah, it is definitely one that I really want to play, and I was very frustrated when I saw that it came out right in this window, because again, it's just like, I cannot possibly justify to myself buying this game right now, especially because it seems like it is a game that will very quickly go on sale, is my impression.
Probably, yeah.
And so it's just like, if I just wait like a month, I'll probably be able to get it for cheaper and then actually devote the time to playing Tetris Effect. Because it is like, you know, I haven't played any of Mizuguchi's other games, but I'm always interested in them. I've always been interested in them from like the outside looking in. And because he has such a distinctive style in his like goal of generating this like totally meditative experience in a video game is so fascinating to me. And that quality of like Tetris is just the perfect game for that, because it's like what you were describing, that once you like are really in Tetris, it's like the perfect game for getting you to enter that flow state where you are reacting just sort of spontaneously and not thinking about anything, and that's just the perfect mix with Mizuguchi's style and the music and all that stuff. So yeah, Tetris Effect seems awesome. People should, again, check out that E3 trailer, because you will watch the E3 trailer and be like, oh fuck, I need to buy this game now, because it's very good.
Yeah. I should note, the game is priced higher than I think people would expect for a Tetris game. It's a $40 release. Having played it, I think that's perfectly fair. I think it is. Because I should say, it's not just that core journey mode, which is huge. It's like 38 levels, which is, considering how much work goes into every one of those and how much music is in there, it's a lot. But then there is also a whole series of what they call effects modes, which is pretty much you can play Tetris however the hell you want. And there's all the classic modes like Marathon and Ultra and all of that. But there's all these new modes they've made. Like, there's a mystery mode where it just starts doing random shit to your board in the middle of the game, including flipping it upside down, and you try to survive 150 lines. It's very hard and very fun and satisfying. They do weekend events with like the community where you all work together to like get enough points to unlock new avatars and stuff. It's neat, and I think it's worth the price to me, but I'm also like a Tetris aficionado here, so like, yeah, you can decide for yourself if it's worth it. I agree, it will probably go on sale. This will almost certainly be a PS Plus game in 4 years.
Yeah, it definitely has that feel as well. Like you said, it has like a very cult classic kind of feel to mm-hmm. it.
My understanding is this is a PlayStation exclusive. I don't know if it'll go wider at some point. It's like Sony Interactive is in the credits, so I don't know the exact scenario, but for now at least it's not going anywhere else.
Yeah, I would not be surprised to see it eventually go to PC, because that's where the other VR platforms are. But yeah, like, I do not think it would ever go to Xbox, because even though, as you said, like, it seems like it is more than incredible to just play it on a normal PS4, Mizuguchi has been for, like, longer than the, like, modern wave of VR, been, like, a big VR guy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like, last year, I think he came out with, actually, with the launch of the PSVR, he had that, like, updated version of Rez that used it. So, I think it would be not entirely unexpected for that to go to other platforms that have VR, but I don't think it would go anywhere that didn't have that potential.
That's probably correct, yeah. So, all right, that is my piece of stuff. Sean, you want to talk some Red Dead 2?
Yeah, let's talk about some Red Dead, the Redemption 2.
I have had such an interesting journey with this game, Sean, because I went from week one mostly loving it, some things I wasn't sure about, but I'm like, this is really cool, to week two where I'm like, this is still really cool in these ways, but it's got these problems I didn't see before. I'm not sure how I'm feeling about Red Dead 2. And having week three, finished the game, beaten the main story, I'm playing the end game stuff. I love Red Dead Redemption 2. It made me cry several times. I've had a journey with this game. What about you?
So, yeah, so for breaking it down into weeks, week one was chapter one and a little bit of chapter two. Week two was chapter two. And then week three was chapter three. And I'm a couple of missions into chapter four, and have mostly just been fucking around in Saint-Denis for today, because I think I finished chapter three last night. So I'm still doing my slow, gradual pace. My, like, feelings on the game have not particularly evolved since last time. I'm still extremely positive on it. I'm still getting lost in doing a bunch of random shit. Like, I just had a moment where, you know, there's a mission in chapter three where after the end of the mission, like, something happens and, like, it has one of those title cards that says a few weeks later. And so the game picks up a few weeks later from that, the end of that mission, and your hair is grown out and you have a massive beard. And I was playing a fairly clean shaven Arthur at that point. I was like, well, like, that, the end of that mission was very traumatizing for Arthur, and now he looks like a crazy mountain man. So I'm just going to go, and I spent, like, that whole day playing that game just up in the mountains doing crazy mountain man shit and finding lost treasure and attacking people and hunting wolves and just going at it. And yeah, that's still the pace I've been playing at the game, and I just adore it. And I do think the story has gotten more involving for me, and some of the stuff that happens at the end of chapter three I found really compelling. And, like, it was the first time getting near the end of chapter three that kind of, like, really pulled me through several missions in a row. And there's something about, I feel like I'm pretty well aligned in some ways with what Rockstar is doing with Red Dead Redemption 2, because I am very happy and willing to go and do all the random open world stuff and kind of, like, generate my own fun there. But then I also I find myself being very fine with the heavily scripted style of the missions, because I'm just like, I will like let you kind of take the reins for, like, the next 30 minutes or whatever, Rockstar, and kind of play the way that you want me to play and see, like, you know, this very cinematic kind of, like, extravagant set piece and all that stuff. Like, there's a very cool scene near the end of chapter three where you and, like, you have a whole posse of your gang, like, marching up on this manor. And it's like all that stuff I just find very, just, like, very involving in, again, that kind of, like, weird cinematic video gamey kind of way. And so I'm personally not having a hard time switching between those modes at that point, or this point in the game, and I'm having a great time with it.
So I'm going to tread lightly here, Sean.
Yes.
I don't want to spoil it for you or anyone else.
Thank you.
But last week on the show, you know, you speculated, maybe Red Dead 2 will be the kind of game that I don't even, like, finish the story with, which you've done with some open world games in the past. I will implore you, and I will implore everyone else playing Red Dead 2, finish this goddamn story. This is the best story Rockstar has ever told. This is one of the best stories ever told in a video game. And it does not play its hand until Chapter 6. But when this game plays its hand, and it starts tying things together that you as a player, maybe you did, but I did not even see were in the realm of going to be tied together. And I don't just mean story points, but systems in the game, things in the world, things in the camp, things you as a character, all the different ways you express yourself, which we've talked about so much, that this is a game that allows for so much expression. It makes a narrative choice near the end of Chapter 5 into Chapter 6 that is one of the boldest and most interesting choices I've ever seen in a video game, and it holds itself to that, and it becomes a truly in-depth, beautiful, engaging, deep exploration of human morality and the choices that define us in a way I did not know Rockstar had this ahead of him. I did not know this game, as good as it is up to that point, was headed there. I didn't know how much meat was on the bones of this game until it really starts going into all of it. And I was so moved. And the things that happen in the story and in my personal player relationship with Arthur Morgan, who I think is one of the all-time great video game characters, the things that I felt playing through Chapter 6 of this game, which I slowed way the hell down on and played very differently than I had up to that point, are just so interesting to me. And Sean, you will understand this. Our listeners will understand this. This is how much of an impact the story choices in Red Dead 2 had on me. I ended the game with full level honor.
Holy shit.
What? I made a conscious choice at a certain point of, I'm going to turn my life around. And I slowed way down in that game so that I could get my honor all the way up. And I beat that game with the highest honor you can have. And that was coming from a point where I had nearly the lowest.
Yeah, it should be stressed that it is much more difficult to get your honor up than it is to get your honor down. Like, it is a slow climb to get that honor to the top.
And I just was so... Again, I have never, playing any Rockstar game, felt compelled to play by the law or to be honorable, because these games are sandboxes of chaos, and the Grand Theft Auto games really give you no inspiration to be good, and Red Dead 1 sort of did, but the world was... Like, I think the story did, but the world itself did not. And this game just... It opened up to me so much when I decided I was going to play this differently and go on this new path, and... I would also implore anyone playing this, when you get to Chapter 6, do everything that is optional. Find every stranger, find every other mission. I complained about this last week. Some of the stranger missions in this game are the worst part of this game, because they are really annoying and vapid and insipid in that way where, like, Rockstar can write just the stupidest, most annoying loudmouth characters. There's definitely some of that in the stranger missions in Red Dead 2, until you get to Chapters 5 and 6. And then the people who open up in the world, it's the best stuff. And there's a thing that happens very near the end of this game that would not have happened to me or hit me in the way it does if I had not done everything I did with the game and gone far afield and found everything. There are moments of storytelling in the final chapter that are so transcendent. I was, like, regularly tearing up. The writing was so beautiful. The amount of humanity on display, again, I just didn't know Rockstar had this in them. If I were to say one quality I think their games lack in comparison to other video games, it is often humanity to me. It is that feeling of like, you know, Red Dead 1, I think, has this in pieces, but it's more like a stylistic exercise that's very good on that level. But this game feels so achingly human to me. And it's just a tremendous story. I love it. I think the ending is incredibly powerful. And this is also the kind of game where by ending I kind of mean like the last 10 hours, you know?
Right.
But the entire Chapter 6, the end of Chapter 5, blew me the hell away. And I'm definitely ending my time with this game so much more positive than I started it. Than I was maybe last week. You've got to see it through. The end game stuff is interesting. It kind of feels like Red Dead 2 shipped with its own single player DLC, because that's basically what they give you at the end, is like, here's another campaign. And it's very weird. It's interesting that it's there. I would kind of recommend that if you're playing this game, when you reach the end, walk away from it for a little bit. It feels like you're supposed to have a gap in. It feels like a DLC that would have come out a year later. Is the epilogue content. So I would just say, like, it's a little distancing if you go right into it, which the game kind of wants you to do. But it's still good, and I'm curious where all of this extra content is going. But I love this game. So hopefully I treaded lightly enough there. There's good stuff coming along for you, Sean.
Yeah, I no longer have the impression that this is a thing that I'm not going to finish, like last week, where it's like, you know, because I think Chapter 2, the story stuff is fine, but it's like, feels very non-essential in some ways, because it's like very, like, oh, I kind of have a little bit of adventure with this guy, and I have a little, like, thing with this guy, and it doesn't really come together, and it wasn't until the end of Chapter 3 that it's like, okay, there's, stuff feels more essential, and like the story missions started to feel more consequential to me in a way that has made me like I feel like I will be much further in the game when we talk next week than my pace has been up to this point, partially because I have done so much random extra stuff already that there's I have run out of some extra stuff to do that's like, okay, I kind of have to mainline the story so I can go to some new areas and unlock some new shit, which is what I'm doing now in Saint Denis.
Yeah. I will also say I got so into near the end, not just with the honor system, but with every level of it. Like, I got into full role-playing, like, in-game cosplaying myself as Arthur, you know, where, yeah. Like, I ended that game with... At some point, I think my game glitched in a weird way where I couldn't grow the beard anymore, and that made me sad. Like, and I know there are special things you have to do with the hair tonic. I was doing all of that, but I had gotten my beard at one point to level 8, which is the first one past... Level 7 is where it stops unless you use hair tonic. I got it to level 8. I died. I reloaded a save, and the beard was gone. And what I found out was, I'm like, why is my beard gone? I was so sad, because getting a level 8 beard in Red Dead 2 is really hard. And so I went to the barber, and no, I still had a level 8 beard. It just wouldn't show. And I had to trim it down to level 7 for the hair animation to come back. And after that, I could never grow it again. So I don't know what happened with that. I think it's some kind of glitch, clearly, because I worked, trust me, I was really trying to grow that beard out. But, like, Arthur had the longest hair, the longest beard, I dressed him like a hobo, it was all part of how I was, like, playing this character, and it speaks to what you've talked about, Sean, the level of like, that's maybe not how you're expressing your Arthur, but my Arthur feels very close to me because of that goddamn hobo beard.
Yeah, for me, it's like the opposite of one of the reasons why I liked having him clean-shaven is that, like, that's a look that you have to maintain. That's not a look that just, like, you can pick and then you stick with and then it never changes. Whereas, like, if you go to, I'm just going to go full Wild Mountain Man, at a certain point, you just always look like Wild Mountain Man. Whereas if you want to be clean-shaven, it means that if you've been out on the road for a couple of days, you have to, like, eventually go, oh, I need to go back to camp, and I'm going to sleep, and I'm going to get up, shave, change my clothes, like, carry this hay bale over here, and then I'm going to go out into the world again after I say hi to everybody. Like, it's those little, like, routines in the game. That's, like, one of the reasons why I chose that look. I also just think that Arthur looks better clean. I like him having a little bit of scruff.
Beard is magnificent. It is so magnificent, and the way it is modeled and animated and the lighting on it, I love it.
It's a good-looking beard. The problem is the long hair and the beard starts clipping through things in the animations and stuff. It is like, you know, it's a problem that all video games have with that kind of stuff, but I was like, I don't know. I enjoyed having the Mountain Man look after the end of that mission that kind of like gave it to me because so much in-game time had passed, and I liked being that for that little section of the story because it felt right. But then when I got into Saint Denis, I was like, okay. And there's like a certain mission you get with a character that Arthur feels like, well, Arthur wouldn't want to look a little bit gussied up for this character, so I'm going to go, and like now's the time to go visit the barber and get my hair shorn and cleaned up and buy a nice new suit.
I did that. I actually did that throughout Chapter 4. I wore the very fancy outfits. I even had a top hat at one point. And it wasn't really until Chapters 5 and 6 that I went full scruffy. But, like, it is to the point, Sean, where, like, on the back of the box, they have a clean-shaven Arthur in one of the pictures. And that's not Arthur to me. Like, it's like in Mass Effect when, like, for me, when I look at the cover of Mass Effect 2, I'm like, this isn't... I didn't play this game. Who's this weird-ass white guy on here? Like, that's not Commander Shepard. Commander Shepard is a woman with like really black hair in a bun and black lipstick and really pale skin because that's how I always played her in Mass Effect. And it's like in Red Dead 2, no, who is this fucking clean-shaven dude? My Arthur Morgan looks like he's a character in The Grapes of Wrath. Like, that's who Arthur Morgan is. I need that. So, but I love but that speaks to how good the game is. Like, that's my point, is that you create a real connection through how you choose to express the character. And I love that. Because, again, the character's fate doesn't really change. I don't think that's a spoiler to say. Like, the game is scripted. It's not like Mass Effect where you massively change, like, the voice of the character or something. But you still get so much expression in there. It's so great. Yeah. I've really come around to love this game. And it's just, it's a special thing. And I recommend people play it.
I love doing these podcast discussions because it reminds me, I'm like thinking back to, and I want to, it'd be fun to go back and re-listen to our Grand Theft Auto 5 podcast because I remember there was like the first week where you were like, man, this game is amazing and I just love this game. And you're like so high on that game. And then the next week you're like, I fucking hate this game. And this, like, Red Dead 2, while like, I don't think like the beginning or the middle part were as extreme with Red Dead 2, I like that we've had like, this one has like a final hump where you're like, no, actually this game is fucking amazing. And with a GTA 5 did not have that final hump for anybody.
Here's what I will tell you guys. Red Dead 2, the last stretch of the story is the exact qualitative inverse of the last stretch of GTA 5.
That's good.
Because the last stretch of GTA 5 is the just saddest wet fart in video game history. And this is the exact opposite of whatever that is. And I think you guys will love it. It's really special. This is such a weird game. It is such a philosophical game on some level. I am still so curious what like the larger community is going to wind up like deciding the legacy of Red Dead 2 is, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of that's going to be decided by Red Dead Online whenever that comes out. But yeah, it's a really interesting game. When you're finished with the story, I also want to theorize about what the hell Red Dead 3 is going to be. Because there's going to be a Red Dead 3.
Oh, yes.
This game has already made $1 billion. And usually when we say $1 billion, we're joking, but it actually has made $1 billion. It's made the GDP of some small countries. There will be a Red Dead 3, and there's not the same, like, obvious, like, this is who the next story is about, where Red Dead 1 kind of had that with this, like, well, Red Dead 1 was about the Vanderlyn gang, maybe we go back and do the story of the Vanderlyn gang, and that's what they did, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm very curious what the next one is.
Well, I think we came to that conclusion last time, that the Red Dead Redemption 3 is Grand Theft Auto 6, and it's Arthur Morgan wakes up Captain America style in the future, because he's been cryogenically frozen. I thought that's what it was.
I would love that. I would love that. They could do it. And just take both of their franchises, make a super franchise. You can go around Liberty City on a horse or in a car.
Man, I would love just to be able to play a mission in Red Dead Redemption 3 where you're Arthur Morgan and you go and kill Trevor from Grand Theft Auto 5. And you just fucking... Cause,
it's a bounty. You get a bounty on him.
Yeah, because I'm the one character I'm very excited to see what the fuck happens to, because I just hate him so much, as Micah. Because Micah in your camp, he feels he's like awful. The Trevor of this game, but this feels like this game knows that he's like the Trevor. It's fucking Micah, you fucking piece of shit. It's every time I see him, it's like, you mother. He's like the only person in the camp I regularly antagonize. Everybody else, I'm like, hey man, what's up? And Micah's like, fuck off, Micah. Go fuck yourself, you asshole.
Well, you will not be disappointed in that. To learn that Micah does play a central role in the story going forward, because he is an asshole for a reason.
Okay, good. Yeah. Fucking Micah.
Fucking asshole, I know. But now that you say all that, I really, sincerely, in GTA 6, they could make this the pre-order bonus. I would pre-order GTA 6 today if they announced this. I want a Red Dead weapons pack in GTA 6.
Yeah.
So, like, wherever that game is set, let's say it's Liberty City, you go in and you could use your little sawed-off shotgun and just blow off people's heads. Because we have not talked about it much on here. I almost exclusively use shotguns in Red Dead 2 because the animations when you shoot people with shotguns are the gnarliest fucking shit. And you literally just see heads explode. It is the best animations for a zombie game, not in a zombie game, ever.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of one other thing with this game, is I don't know if I will ever be able to go back to using a shotgun in another game. If you, particularly specifically the pump action shotgun, I don't know if you use that one much, Jonathan.
I did not.
Okay, because I am now like the pump action shotgun is like the only rifle type weapon. I'll occasionally use the bolt action rifle for distance, but generally speaking, if I'm like going into a mission that I know I'm going to have to fuck people up, and I know it's basically going to be more or less close quarters, I always take the pump action shotgun because the feel of pulling the trigger and then having to manually pull the trigger again to pump the shotgun, I don't know if I'll ever be able to play a shooter that doesn't do that. Like, it's so...
That's amazing.
It's so satisfying. It's so perfect. It's like, it's that thing of that it just blows my mind that no other video game I've ever played, and I've played a lot of fucking shooter games in my time, has ever tried that before, of having the pump action thing be a thing you do manually in the game. Because it's just... It's that thing of you know, the mechanical satisfaction of it, and like the tactile feel of it is so heightened by that little extra bit of control you have. And that's true of like all the different guns that have that sort of component to it. And it's just, yeah, I just don't know. Because it's even just the little shit of, like, when you pull out the pump-action shotgun and then you aim it, he pumps it for the first time. Or if you fire it and then he aims it, he'll pump it. It's just, man, it's so good. Like, those little choices they made in Red Dead 2 are a lot of things that I think most people will either, like, not really notice or be confused by or be frustrated by. But all of those things are the things that, to me, like, 100% make this game what it is. And it's the kind of thing that's going to make it hard for me to go back to other games that don't have that level of detail or that level of, like, kind of curiosity and exploration to them in what kinds of systems can you put into a game and have it still work.
Absolutely. I have not used a pump action shotgun yet. I just, because that's one you don't get in the story. So
no, yeah, you have to buy it.
Yeah, and I wound up using my money to get the repeater shotgun. And that one is also awesome if you haven't used it, because it gives you, it's basically as powerful as any other shotgun, but you have 6 shots in the chamber that you can do. And that was my go-to, it still is my go-to rifle, and I fucking love it. But now that I've heard about the pump action, I will go get a pump action shotgun.
Yeah. It just makes me feel like Sarah Connor in Terminator 2 and, like, all the cool shit she does with the shotgun in that movie. It's like, God, just so, like, because I didn't think anything would be able to pull me away from the double-barreled shotgun, because the double-barreled shotgun is fucking great. It was my favorite weapon in Red Dead 1. It's great in this one. But I was like, I have so much money. I will just buy this pump action shotgun and see what it's like. And then I used it. It's like, fucking, the shotgun is the best gun in every shooter game. Like, it always is. It always will be. And this is probably my favorite shotgun in any game I've played. So
awesome. Yeah. Now I just want the one from Terminator 2 that the Terminator uses, where he flips it around.
Yeah.
While riding the motorcycle and Arnold Schwarzenegger breaks both of his fingers. Yes.
Yeah.
You should be able to do that in Red Dead 2. Ride your horse, try to do that, and if you mess it up, Arthur breaks his fingers, and you have to, like, go to camp and set them and sleep 6 weeks for the bones to heal.
Yes, exactly. That's what Red Dead 3 needs to be, is just go so hardcore with all that shit.
If you flip your horse over, you just break your femur, and you have to see if you're going to die of an infection. You have to, like, see if you can get into town to find penicillin, because the bone was sticking out.
Yeah, it's like, you better hope it didn't happen in winter, or you're seriously fucked.
Permadeath. You can. Yeah. It's a 60-hour campaign, but if you die at hour 55, it wipes your file.
Fucking A, man. I would 100% love just to see them go even further in that direction and see how far they can bend it before people just riot in the streets.
Sean, they could totally bring back, to a whole new degree, you have died of dysentery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Sean, I have 2 pieces of news, both of which I'm really just having here because they made me laugh, and they're funny.
Okay.
So the first one is, did you see Square Enix held the world's weirdest live stream this week about Final Fantasy 15?
Oh, right. Fuck, that was this week. Oh, my God. All the FF15 stuff is crazy.
Square. Okay, let me see if I can get through this. So Square Enix held, this was not a press release, this was a live stream, to announce that they are canceling 3 out of 4 new planned DLCs for Final Fantasy 15.
Which, I want to stop you right there, Jonathan. Did you have any idea that there were going to be 4 more single-player DLC packs for Final Fantasy 15 before this?
Yes, and I'm pretty sure there's a podcast segment where we talked about it, but we've forgotten about it because it's been so long.
Jesus.
Yeah. It was supposed to be around all the, like, periphery characters in it, you know? Yeah. And so they've canceled 3 of them. They're going to finish episode Arden, which is the DLC about the game's villain, and that's going to come out in March. But after that, Final Fantasy 15 is done, because the second major announcement is that Hajime Tabata, the director of Final Fantasy 15, has full-on resigned from Square Enix. That was next-level weird, Sean. They held a press conference to announce, we're canceling most of the game, and the director quit.
Yeah,
I've never seen anything like that.
It was just so strange, particularly for me, that I didn't even realize or had forgotten at some point that they were making more single-player things for Final Fantasy 15. Looking at it, it's just like, wait, okay, they were still making stuff in this game, but now they're not anymore, except for they're going to do the first one, and Tabata left. It's I'm so perplexed. I'm perplexed, but I am also very upset, Jonathan, over the nature of what has occurred here, because they're only completing one of them, which is the episode Arden one, but they had in production an episode Aranea, who is, of course, the character voiced by Miyuki Sawashiro, the best character, my favorite character, the only character really of note, probably in Final Fantasy XV, Aranea, the character I remember most fondly. And it is then with the greatest regret that I have to now publicly on the podcast actually rescind the reward I gave to Final Fantasy XV in our 2016 Game of the Year podcast, which was the Miyuki Sawashiro's Award for Peculiar Excellence.
It was actually the inaugural award, right?
It was the inaugural award, and apparently Square Enix didn't read the fucking fine print on that award, which said that if at any point in the future, with this video game, there is a piece of DLC content planned in beginning development, starring or otherwise primarily featuring Miyuki Sawashiro's beloved character Aranea, and that then DLC add-on is unceremoniously or like strangely ceremoniously canceled, then this award will be revoked. And so now I have to take it away.
Well, Sean, who was your runner-up in 2016 for the Miyuki Sawashiro Award for Peculiar Excellence? Because now we've got to figure out who that award goes to.
You know, I'll have to conduct...
I'm bringing up her Wikipedia page right now, Sean.
Okay, well...
We're doing this live.
Yeah, we can do this live. Fuck it, we're doing it live.
All right, so let's see, filmography, television. I have to scroll through a lot. She is a prolific actress.
She definitely is. She's... Some might argue she is the greatest actress ever to have lived, and those people would be right.
Sean, I'm going to read you a list of her 2016 video games.
Okay.
All right. League of Legends, Final Fantasy XV, Skullgirls, Street Fighter V, Sword Art Online, Hollow Realization, World of Final Fantasy, Zero Escape, Zero Time Dilemma, Dragon Quest Heroes 2, Mighty No. 9, and Tales of Berseria. Do you have a candidate there for Miyuki Sawashiro's Award for Peculiar Excellence 2016?
See, it's frustrating because I have not played any of those other video games, but I'm just going to go ahead.
Wait, Sean, I've got it. She was in Yakuza 0. It came out 2015 in Japan, but it came out 2016 in America, didn't it?
No, it came out 2017 because that's the award I gave, because I gave that award to that game in 2017.
You did, okay. I was trying to find you an out. I'm sorry.
No, so it can't. So it has to go then to, I'm going to say, Street Fighter V. I haven't played Street Fighter V, but I have played Street Fighter II, and I think I've played a version of Street Fighter III. But I also know that the fighting game community, in terms of like the hardcore people that played at like the tournaments, really love a lot of the fighting game additions and changes in the base fighting game of Street Fighter V. But of course, Street Fighter V is infamous for being basically fucked in every other regard. And therefore, it's actually kind of like Final Fantasy XV in a lot of respects. And so it is. It seems very excellent. It seems very peculiar in its excellence. And it's just a peculiar phenomena in the history of fighting games in general. So I am very pleased to announce that Miyuki Sawashiro is now granting her Award for Peculiar Excellence for 2016 to Street Fighter V, in which she played Cammy, Eliza, and a character named DeCapra that I don't know who that is.
All right, well... Congratulations to Street Fighter V. Shame on Final Fantasy XV for losing that award 2 years after the fact.
They had the most prestigious, sought-after award in the world for anything ever, and they just fucking threw it away, Jonathan. All they needed to do was say, who fucking gives a shit about Arden? I barely remember him. All I remember is that he was the villain, and I was very confused about his motivations by the end of that game. So who cares about that asshole? Fucking make your Aranea episode, assholes, and then you can leave and cancel the game.
So let's back up for a second here, because the weirder thing about this is that Final Fantasy XV, it came out in 2016, it had a long, troubled development, and it felt unfinished in some ways, it was brilliant in some ways, it was a very interesting game, it was my number two game of the year, I really liked it. And then Square Enix decided, maybe because they had spent 10 fucking years funding this game, that they were going to act as if Final Fantasy XV were not a single-player JRPG, and they were going to try to gaslight everyone who bought it into thinking it was like an MMO with constant updates, and that's what they tried to do. So they had a season of DLC, which is not that weird in and of itself, but it was three episodes with the other characters in your party, and those were sort of like old Mass Effect DLCs, but more extreme parts of the story. Like, you had to go back into the campaign and see them, because they were filling in gaps in the main narrative. And they rewrote the ending, kind of a la Mass Effect 3, and added stuff in. And I think it was chapter 13 the one that people disliked, that they went in and, like, added a bunch of stuff to, and they added new play modes, and they added a weird multiplayer mode, and they just constantly kept updating it and adding it and tweaking with it, and then they announced, we're going to do a whole second season of this with four more episodes, and we're going to add this and this and this, and they really wanted you to, like, treat Final Fantasy XV not like a discrete single-player experience that you played, you finished, and then you put back on the shelf, but that you kept going back to as though it was Final Fantasy XIV, the actual MMO that they have that is popular and acclaimed. It's been the weirdest strategy I've ever seen. Again, I say this as someone who loved Final Fantasy XV. I've not gone back to it because I played the game. I finished the game. Like, it's weird. It would be like if tomorrow Francis Ford Coppola was like, you guys, I know you all watched and wrote your books on The Godfather back in 1972, but I just added a bunch to the movie. Now we're going to find out what Michael's favorite spaghetti shop in Italy was. We added a bunch of new footage. And it'd be like, that's fucking weird. You made the movie. We watched the movie. Stop it. But that's what they kind of were doing. It was the weirdest strategy. And now they just kind of put up the white flag. And it was the most... I don't know. Square Enix is weird, Sean.
Square Enix is real fucking weird. Because they also put out that Quiet Man game like a week and a half ago. That, like, I say put out, I should say dump out, because that game just came out with no fanfare, no review copies were sent to reviewers, and I don't know if you ever watched any footage from that game after it came out, but it's the, like, most disastrous fucking just nightmare video game I've seen a major publisher put out in this fucking decade. Like, it's been so long since a major publisher has just shat out a fucking bullshit video game like that before, because video games are very expensive and costly to make, both in terms of money and just in terms of time and the lives of the people who make it. And that game just, what the fuck? So they dumped that out. They canceled their weird Final Fantasy XV DLC plans. Tabata just sort of peaced out and was just like, fuck off, I'm gone. Like, no.
Because the funniest part is he didn't just quit the game, he quit the company.
Yeah. He didn't move on to another project internally and be like, I'm done developing on this game that, like, was also, you know, you sort of, you know, intimated before had a, like, a long, troubled production history. But the long, troubled production history does not always describe, like, what, like, the 10 years that that game was in development as, like, Final Fantasy Versus 13. And then Tetsuya Nomura, who's the original game director, just couldn't fucking get that game made. And so they brought Tabata in as basically like a pinch hitter and be like, you have to close this fucking game and get this game actually made from all this bullshit that Nomura couldn't actually, you know, finish because he was making five other games at the same time, like Kingdom Hearts 3. And so the Tabata did all that. And then the game came out and it was impressive and strange. And some might call it peculiarly excellent, but can't call it that anymore. And so it was interesting, and then they just kept on making it, and it felt like, what the fuck are you doing? And now we're here, and now Tabata's hopefully somewhere being happy with this decision, being free, because, you know, he was fucking chained to that thing for a long time, is what it felt like.
I mean, we should say at this juncture, Hajime Tabata did ludicrously impressive work on that game.
Oh, yes.
Given that, as you say, like, he was brought in initially as Nomura's co-director to help him finish it. Nomura wound up getting moved over to Kingdom Hearts 3 when they finally decided we're going to make this game. And then Tabata had, what, 2-3 years at that point? They had a lot of work done, but they did not have a game. And he had to finish this thing, get it out the door. When you look at it in those conditions, it was very impressive. He, I think, gave, over the last couple of years, some of the best and most candid developer interviews I've ever seen. He was just so open about it. He was very communicative with the community. But it was kind of this impossible circumstance because I don't think anyone at Square Enix knew what they wanted out of this fucking game, you know? Like, because again, when you're trying to gaslight all of your players into thinking this game is not a single-player, discrete JRPG, which is what it is, I don't know what you're doing at that point. It's an impossible position. So, you know, he's moved to a farm upstate. Hopefully he's happy there. But, that was... Why did they do this in a live stream, Sean? Why was this not a press release on a Friday night?
I don't know, man. Square Enix, it's just like this. I feel like this, maybe all this actually started when they let go of IO and lost Hitman. And they're just like, that's when they lost their fucking minds, because Hitman was the best game that came out in 2016. and they just let it go. They just, like, let it off the leash.
It's really too bad Miyuki Sawashiro wasn't in Hitman in, like, the Japanese dub. Like, she wasn't, like, the handler woman. Because, one, she would have been perfect at that. And, two, you could give Hitman that prestigious award and take your favorite game and your favorite actress and just put them together.
Fuck, she would be so good at that. Oh, man. God damn it, Jonathan. I don't think there is a Japanese language dub of Hitman.
That'd be
pretty
great, though.
If they make it. That would be great, and that's who it needs to be.
Who would play Agent 47? Now we're off topic. Who would play Agent 47 in the Japanese dub of Hitman?
Oh, jeez. Solid Snake. What's his name? Akio Itsuka.
That'd be pretty good. It's kind of obvious, but it would be pretty good.
He's one of the best, and he has the right gravelly voice for it, and he's got a good deadpan delivery he can do. That's who I'd get.
Okay. Anyway, all right, let's move on to my other piece of news, which is also from Japan. This is Masahiro Sakurai, the creator of Super Smash Bros., and the man we all love and are worried for because he's working himself to death to make us, you know, have Piranha Plant in Smash Bros. Ultimate and all that other stuff. He sent out two tweets this week, and they were both notably... He sent these tweets in English, like perfectly composed English. They did not have Japanese versions of these tweets, which most of his timeline is Japanese. So this was very pointed to a certain segment of the community. And these are both simultaneously very sad and very amazing. Did you see this, Sean?
Yes, although I don't remember the specific contents of the tweet.
Well, here it is. Super Smash Bros. Ultimate's DLC lineup is now complete. This time, the selection was made entirely by Nintendo. I decide if we can create a fighter based on their selection, and then they come up with the plan. It's great to dream about your favorite character joining the battle, and I appreciate your passion. But please try to stay on topic when replying to tweets and refrain from flooding us, and other users, with requests when we're not specifically asking for feedback. Thank you. By Japanese standards, that is the bitchiest tweet ever since, and I love it.
Yeah. It is, and then also put Goku in the game. That's just all I have to say about it. If he puts Goku in the game, fucking everyone's going to be fine, and we'll be happy, and people will stop sending bullshit tweets.
I mean, it's interesting the detail about Nintendo kind of drove the ship on this one, not him, because that's a little different than they usually do it, so I'm curious where that's leading. But I love that he's like, please stay on topic. Don't send more requests. Because this is the thing about Sakurai, is you know he's the guy who actually, like, he listens. He takes this to heart. He knows what the fans want. He tries to accommodate. And I think he probably, this feels like it was sent at like 4 a.m. one night when he'd been working on the game all day, working on, maybe it is Goku. We don't know. And he's just like.
Better be.
He's just like, these ungrateful motherfuckers. God damn these people! And these English people specifically, because he sent this out in English, not in Japanese. I just love it. We are impossible to please, and, you know, I hope you get some rest, Sakurai.
I think it is very simple to please me in this specific regard. I think I've been very clear. Put Goku in the game.
All right. Maybe you can tweet that at him. Okay.
This is extremely on topic, Mr. Sakurai. Put Goku in the game, please. Thank you.
Yes. All right. You want to talk some Doctor Who?
Yeah, let's talk about Doctor Who.
It was good this week.
It was good this week.
It wasn't great, but it was pretty good.
It was a solid fucking episode of Doctor Who. I enjoyed it.
It was interesting. I think it felt a little unlike any episode I've seen before. It had a point of view the show has not employed before. I think it was generally very well written. I think it has an interesting final 20 minutes. I think the character writing is generally better. You know, maybe the X factor here was just Chris Chibnall is fucking terrible at writing this show. And Vinay Patel, who wrote this one, is good at it. And so that was nice. Yes. So Demons of the Punjab was this week's episode, written by Vinay Patel, directed by Jamie Childs, who also directed the premiere. And just, again, like, we'll dive into it by all, pretty much every measure. This was a better episode. And Sean, do you want to tell us why?
Oh, I mean, it's, they told a coherent, solid story that had a core thematic concept that had really well-developed characters, particularly like the guest characters. Were just really well drawn characters that were all very relevant acted incredibly well and that had a solid, specific storyline that they followed through from beginning to end. I think the beginning was a little bit iffy in some parts, but the ending is way more important, particularly to a story like this. And yeah, like once it starts moving into gear about halfway through the episode, I think it really does transition to being a really strong episode of Doctor Who that ends incredibly powerfully. And there are little quibbles I have here and there. There's some things I wish they had done differently. Although part of this feels like a little bit like my reaction to The Last Jedi, in that I really like this episode, and my most significant complaints with it are things that aren't really this episode's fault.
I agree.
Or things set up by the predecessors or not set up by the predecessors properly. That means that this episode ends up having a bigger burden than an episode like this should have in terms of the Doctor and the cast. But if you put those aside and just look, appreciate it as an episode of television unto itself, I think it's really well done.
I agree. And I was kind of like being flippant when I said it isn't great. Again, I don't know if I would call this like one of the great Doctor Who episodes, but it is really solid. And I think I might like it even more in the future if I can go back and watch it in isolation, you know?
Yeah.
And not go in with the rock bottom expectations I had this week, as I felt like, oh my god, I'm actively dreading Doctor Who now. What has happened to this world? But I agree. It's almost the exact opposite of the first five episodes in that it gets better as it goes along, not weaker, which is what all the other ones do. They start out with like a certain amount of energy, and then it's just dead on the floor, flopping around like a fish out of water by the end. This episode, I agree, it's got some shaky stuff in it. I think it, in part because the characters have been so ill-defined, it doesn't know how to get into the story. But I don't think that's the episode's fault. I think that's, like, who these characters are. I think there's some clunkiness. Again, spoilers. You know how it goes on this show. With, like, how long they spend on the monsters who aren't actually monsters. Like, I feel like that reveal should have been earlier. But when they do the reveal, I really liked it. It's very much feels like Twice Upon a Time. But I think it's well done. And, you know, those last 20 minutes feel very different for Doctor Who. Because it's just, there is no sci-fi component at that point. It's kind of like a pure historical in that way. There's nothing really the characters are trying to stop or alter. It's just about this part of the world at this moment in time. And, you know, the character Yaz seeing this piece of her heritage. And it's powerful stuff, and it's deeply felt. It feels like it comes from a personal place. As I said, I think it has a point of view that's so different. Like, you know, I cannot speak to what the Pakistani, you know, diasporic experience is like. But, for instance, this felt tremendously more authentic to me than the Rosa Parks stuff did in episode 3 this year, where as an, you know, I'm not African American, but as an American, I could at least say this is all wrong. This felt at least like there was some really personal stuff here going on. I think its historical component is really interesting because that's a piece of world history that I didn't really know about, sadly. I think a lot of people don't. And I think the whole theme of like bearing witness is really interesting. I think Jodie Whittaker gets a much better written version of the Doctor this week, including our first kind of substantive moment of gender mattering to this Doctor. I think Bradley Walsh has his best moment on the show so far, and he's the one companion who's consistently been great, so that's saying something. I think Yaz comes out of this feeling like a real companion. Poor Ryan has not had a goddamn thing to do since the premiere, and I'm not sure why he's on this show, and I'm really not sure why he started the season as like the main character when they had nothing for him the rest of the season. But again, this is a good episode.
Yes. Yeah, I think you hit on most of the things I liked and most of the things I didn't like. There's one element of this episode, which is something that I've been sort of grappling with a little bit and thinking about it. And when I rewatch it, it's something I'm curious to see how I feel about it. But there's a little bit of this episode kind of feels like, to me, it would be better if it wasn't an episode of Doctor Who. Like, it kind of feels like its Doctor Who-ness holds it back. And it's like, if this was just a straight historical drama, it was like, because that's when it's good. When it's good and when it's like really good is when all the Doctor Who-ness of it kind of fades away. And the most of it is just like the fact that Yaz is from the future, which doesn't need to be Doctor Who. And is not actually like the, like taking someone into their like specific past is not even a particularly like common or oft used Doctor Who storytelling device at all. So like that doesn't feel especially Doctor Who-y to me. And it's just something of where it's like, I think that Jodie Whittaker gets some of her better stuff in the story, but then at the same time, like, the Doctor feels so non-essential to the story, and in fact, Graham is the character that feels like has the most, like, I get to, like, have the wise speeches and kind of, like, guide Yaz through this experience more than the Doctor ever has, and it's kind of a weird element of it that makes me feel like I really enjoyed this episode a lot, but I don't know if I enjoyed this episode a lot as an episode of Doctor Who, if that makes sense.
I totally understand that. I think part of it is just how ill-defined the characters have been up to this point, because it's hard to imagine the counterfactual where, you know, what if this was a world where Yaz is the companion? Like, and there aren't mm-hmm. two other companions, and it's the Doctor and Yaz, and they're really well-defined characters, and then they, like, what if this was the episode in the place of, like, Father's Day in season one with Chris Eccleston and Rose Tyler, and Billy Piper as Rose, where, like, you've had this really clear relationship, and then Rose decides she wants to see her dad, and we do this thing, and that's a very different story. I think it might have similar emotional impact if you had that, and then because you don't have a four-person TARDIS crew, you can focus much more on what's going on in the past, and you can let, which this episode does very well, but you could let some of that other stuff fade away. If the monsters, I really like how they're used by the end, but I do think, I'm just not sure, like, I hope this makes sense, but like, yeah, I'm just not sure that the best version of this episode would have as much time spent on them. So I don't know, but it's just impossible to know what the counterfactual version of this episode feels like. So I'm not sure, but I totally see what you mean, because the best stretch of this is the last 10-20 minutes, where it is just about this, you know, Hindu woman and this Muslim man who are in love, and their countries are being torn apart, and there's these, you know, racial and ethnic divisions going on, and they're kind of being torn away from each other, and you have this character Yaz sort of seeing this piece of her heritage she never really understood. And none of that, as you say, has to be Doctor Who. Then again, that's the beautiful thing about Doctor Who, is it can do anything. So I see both sides of it.
I think part of it is that, like, because this is by far the closest we have gotten in modern Doctor Who. And by modern Doctor Who, I don't just mean a new Doctor Who. I mean Doctor Who since the 60s. That version of Doctor Who has gotten to the original concept and design of the true historical from William Hartnell and, like, the beginning of Patrick Troughton's day. And it is that, where it's like, because I do think at the end, at the very end, the concept of, like, these aliens that are bearing witness, I mean, it is very similar to the testimony from Twice Upon a Time, but that's not a big issue. But, like, the concept of those aliens, and they're not monsters, they're not assassins, they're not, like, here to destroy anything or fuck up the timeline or whatever, they're just here to bear witness to this. It's like, it's a good metaphor. It works really well, like, visually at the end, and I love that the shot of, like, them in the ship and, like, all the faces up that of, like, all the people that have died. I think that's all really beautiful, but it is and so I don't necessarily want to lose that stuff, but there's so much time wasted in the first half of this episode of the Doctor chasing around being like, they're the deadliest assassins in the universe, and doing all that stuff and fucking around with the teleporters or the transmats, that feels like is, like, so unnecessary to actually get them to be the witness thing. And, like, that, I don't even know if there ever needs to be a, like, strong misdirection of, oh, we think they're assassins, but actually they're witnesses. It could just be, we don't know what they are. Oh, they're witnesses. And that would cut out, like, 10 minutes of that plot line. But the problem with that is that that's the Doctor's role in this story, is really figuring that out. And once she's figured that out, she kind of has nothing left to do, because Graham has been the one assigned to be like, I'm going to give the consoling speech to Yaz, I'm going to give the consoling speech to the husband, and like, he's kind of gets put into, like, the wise mentor figure role that the Doctor normally would be in an episode like this. But it kind of feels like, to split the duties properly among the characters, she gets spent on the I know all the alien shit stuff, but once that ends up being a pretty fairly inconsequential element of the plot, the Doctor ends up feeling very inconsequential. And I think that's one of the reasons why it feels like, I don't know if this really needed to be an episode of Doctor Who, because I don't know if the Doctor needs to be here to make this story work in any way.
I can see that. I think there's elements. It's too bad, because the entire second half of the episode, I wish just was longer, you know, like it breathed a little more, because there's things like the Doctor, you know, spending the night with the other women and having that, like, they call attention to it as like, oh, I could never have done this as a man. But the subtext of that scene is like her kind of feeling for the first time being in a feminine space that she as a he would never have been in. Which again, I think we have not had this conversation on the podcast. You and I have talked a little bit off the air about it, of how much should they be discussing the Doctor's gender? Because I see both sides of it. I see the side of like, you know, it is very powerful to make the statement that the Doctor is the Doctor regardless of sex, and we don't need to make it a big thing. I think that's very powerful. But I also think there's something really interesting about just how would this eons old being see the world anew as a different gender, you know? Like, that is, you can't ignore that changes perception towards her and from her. And I think this episode has that really nice moment with her and the other women, and then the moment where she does the wedding. And I think a different version of this episode, I could see that being beefed up, where it's not so much about the Doctor playing the role of hero, but like playing the role of the person experiencing history and having history happen to them, and seeing like what is this thing in the world I'm seeing? Kind of like, you know, once in a while I feel like in the Aztecs or something, William Hartnell is sort of more, he's active and there's things he has to do, but he's also got like that romance going on or something. So there's moments like that. But I do think because you have this first half that leans so heavily on the mystery of it, like, I still think, even in that first half, this episode is notably better than the other five. Like, yeah, would you agree with that? Yeah. But it is not, it doesn't become a great or very good Doctor Who episode. That's when you really kick the twist into gear, is when it gets to that level. But I agree. I think the first half you could tighten up so much by just having this, because there is, I do think it gets something out of the characters thinking aliens killed the priest and then realizing the much harder truth is that the brother was radicalized. That's interesting to me. And I think that's the kind of twist only Doctor Who could do here, where the character doesn't want to see what is coming from the brother, and it's because there was this scary alien. I just think you could have had that moment and pared down a lot of the exposition and the running around and the typical Doctor Who stuff and gotten into the part, the meat of the episode faster. But even as it stands, I still think it's very impressive, and I think they get mileage out of all this stuff.
Yeah, I agree. It's just like, there's also just a part of me that really wants like this series to be able to take the big step of just no science fiction element in the Storka at all, because I think this episode does better with it than the vast majority of historicals in modern Doctor Who have done. And particularly like being able to get to the point by the end that it feels really powerful and kind of essential to the episode as it exists now. But there is, it's like so much busy work that is done near the beginning that feels like this, like a problem that modern and this specifically new Doctor Who has had forever since RTD brought it back, which is this like, we just have to like this very belabored, like we have to move through all these plot points. We have to do all this stuff because it's Doctor Who. We have to do X, 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 Y, and Z or whatever and move through this very generic kind of science fiction thing with a very generic monster and move through that stuff. And I think it builds off of the ground that Moffat sort of provided in the last couple of years, and particularly with Twice Upon a Time, of being like, no, at the very least, the monster doesn't have to be evil, because almost always the monster had to be evil. And finally being like, no, we can do an episode where the monster's not evil, and that's fine. And this episode uses that space. But it's like, we really need to be able to get to the point that you can have a historical episode like this and just not have a monster in it at all. Because that's the only way, I think, to like really truly do justice to what they are trying to do with this larger TARDIS crew and with like these like very kind of pointed historical drama episodes that, like, you know, even Rosa, with all of its faults, still had a much more pointed historical drama perspective than any of the other New Who historicals have had. This one has a much more focused, pointed version of it because it's just better written. And I think at some point, unless you can really find a really strong way to blend the science fiction in the historical elements together, it would be so much smarter to just abandon those science fiction elements. And it feels like the show is afraid to move to that point, and something that frustrates me more and more the deeper in we get and the more we see how freeing for the show it would be to be able to abandon that. All that being said, I do think that this episode does really well by that stuff, even if it feels like it is kind of like thrust upon it to need to have that stuff.
Yeah, I understand. Totally. I also want to give a shout out. The monster design this week was good. I thought they looked cool. I thought they felt like they came from a society with an actual aesthetic that made sense. Mm-hmm. Like their ship and their costumes and their, like, the way they moved their hands all felt like this is an actual good piece of production design that tells a story, which we have not had in any of these first five episodes, you know. Again, the weird high point of this season so far being a dude with teeth in his face. This was much, 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 much better than that. But, yeah. So I liked that. Where else do we go with this? Because this episode does exist at such a weird point of the faults of the season are there, but the episode's strengths are really good. What direction do you want to go in?
Let's talk about Yaz, because we finally have a fucking Yaz episode. It took a while.
It took a false Yaz episode.
We thought we had the Yaz episode in Arachnids in the UK, and we really didn't. But now we have a Yaz episode that's actually about Yaz, and it's one of those things that, again, it's just sort of unfortunate that it feels like Yaz is so removed from the other TARDIS crew members at this point. That's one of the things that makes it, like, I don't know, like a lot of the other characters don't have a lot of space in this story. That feels kind of strange because they are part of our main cast. But Yaz serves so well as our sort of POV character, as our main character for the episode. Particularly, I think, again, once you get past kind of the messy opening where I feel like her reactions to things are, like, a little bit too extreme or slightly misaligned for where they need to be with, like, you know, like, oh my god, my grandmother was in love with another dude is, like, it should be a little bit surprising. It's just, like, she was so taken aback by that. I was like, that's a little, like, a bit of an extreme reaction for someone who is, like, in their 70s or something, and you're going back to when she was, like, 20. But other than, like, some of those weird kind of calibration things, I felt like more near the beginning of the episode, her journey as a person, like, confronting her cultural history and these things that she didn't really understand about where she came from, where her nan came from, and that whole element of, like, you know, the partitioning of India and Pakistan. I think that side of the episode was so well done, and she finally, Yaz finally got to be, like, a protagonist and a meaningful character and got to go on a journey over the course of the episode, which is, you know, Ryan got episode one, Graham has been, like, effectively interspersed throughout the episodes, and she just has had nothing ever, and finally she had something, and she's really good.
She's really good, and I've thought, you know, Mandip Gill seemed like she was going to be really good, but we just had no, like, clear test of that through these five episodes. I think she's really good. It's an impressive performance in this one. I think particularly the final scene of the episode with her and the older version of her grandmother back in the present day is a lovely little scene, and I really liked that they chose to end the episode there because I think that was the right place to put the emotional weight of the story. But yeah, she just came across much more strongly. Again, you have to do the mental gymnastics in your mind of, like, but how much better would it have been if we actually knew who Yaz was before this episode? But, you know, it's, I don't know. We don't live in that world. So who knows? Will they give Mandip Gill stuff to do after this episode? I don't
Probably
know.
Not.
We'll see. Probably not. I mean, I would say, though, I think Yaz is a much better defined character at this point than Ryan. I have no fucking clue who Ryan is or is supposed to be, because you're correct in that he had episode one, kind of. But episode one was also very busy. And since then, he's kind of been a different character in every episode. Tossin Cole, I have really no idea what he's playing, not by any fault of his own, just by the kind of schizophrenic characterization. And he is the character I feel like they are most willing to just throw on the back burner because, you know, at least, like, we can joke about Arachnids in the UK, but Yaz is in that one more. It is her family. Ryan is totally in the back burner of that one. He was totally in the back burner last week. Well, not totally. He had the scene with the guy giving birth. But last week was weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, so I don't know. That character now to me feels like if they could snap him into place, we'd be in a good position, but then you still have to do the thing where how the hell do you balance four characters plus an entire guest cast every week, and I still don't see any evidence that that can be done, because this episode doesn't even really try. It just throws Ryan on. Like, in some ways, I think this episode would have been stronger if Ryan had, like, not come along in the TARDIS, because you would have had one fewer, like, people to feed lines to, and they could have focused on other characters more, because he doesn't do anything in the episode.
Yeah, and it's kind of strange that because Ryan is out of the other three main characters between the Doctor, Graham, and Ryan, Ryan is 100% the character that has had most screen time and the most dialogue shared with Yaz out of any of them. Other than maybe kind of the Doctor, but the Doctor's shared dialogue has always been basically 100% plot-related, which has changed at least a little bit in this episode. Ryan and Yaz at least have had a couple little conversations, like in episode one. They had, even if it was kind of weird, their racism conversation in Rosa. So it's like they have a connection. They were at school together. Like there's a friendship there. And Ryan is just like absent this episode. And they give Graham all the like sort of doctory, like I'm like here for you. Like I've been around the block a bit. Like I'm old. I've had experience and I can kind of talk to you about this. Which is good, but like that, because that scene was really well done on its own, but it also just kind of felt strange of like, have these characters ever fucking talked to each other before?
That's true.
Like, I was like legitimately thinking, sitting there thinking, have they ever actually shared a conversation with each other? Because I'm not sure if they did before this point. Or if they did, again, it would have been entirely like, look out, Yaz, the toothy man is over there, you know, like a very plot related, whatever kind of thing. And so it's the kind of, it's like, frustrating that this episode feels like it is hamstrung by, because it's episode 6, we're past the halfway point of the season where this episode comes in, and still the like basic character relationships between the four people are not established really at all, and so it's good in this episode on its own, but when you look at it in relationship to this TV show, it doesn't feel like it is benefited by the episodes that came before it. And it also feels like it'll be hard for this to benefit the episodes that come after, because this episode feels like it is so good on its own island, being its own historical drama dealing with the Yaz character. But like that conversation between Yaz and Graham, I don't know if that's going to feel like it's cumulative to something that's going to be building later, because it doesn't feel like it came from anything that came before. And so it's that weird sort of like, it's the weird almost like paradox of this episode, that this episode's so good on its own, but it is also like so on its own that it kind of frustrates me, because I want the season as a whole to be lifted up.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to know what to do with those things. I don't know where they're going with a lot of this. We still have the issue, probably the most serious issue, if we're being honest, this season, is that the Doctor is not defined with the other characters, you know?
Yeah.
There's no real, like, there's a point in the episode where I think the Doctor says to Yaz, she's explaining, like, why we have to protect the timeline, and she says, like, we can't have a universe without Yaz. And I was like, I've never seen you talk to Yaz. Literally. I've never seen you have a conversation with... I've seen you have a conversation with Graham, Ryan, and Yaz, but I've never seen why you love Yaz. Like, that's a current thing. Like, she says that a lot about Yaz. She really likes Yaz. And I'm like, I don't know why. It's not that I couldn't know why. It's not that I couldn't imagine these two people liking each other a lot. It's just that I don't know. You haven't shown it. And there's just moments like that where there's so much more of the character they could have done. Or, like, you know, the way this episode starts is that Yaz asks the Doctor to go back in time. The Doctor naturally does not want to do it, but acquiesces. It's a little unclear why. And I also see there, like, I don't know if this is intentional, but it feels like there is a character dynamic to the 13th Doctor where she's kind of desperate to maintain her friends. Like, she really doesn't want to be alone, and she really wants these friends to stick by her, and she's kind of codependent on them. But it also kind of feels like David Tennant being manic depressive in the 10th Doctor era, where I'm not sure if that's an intentional character choice or just something that comes about by sort of sloppy writing that makes the Doctor do a lot of different things in different directions. But there's things like that where I see all these openings for character work that hasn't been done. And you're right, it does hamstring this story at certain points, but also means that the good things this story does can't carry forward into future episodes. I assume, who knows what'll come next.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Because it is something where I just feel like, because I just feel like the 13th Doctor just doesn't have a characterization past a very broad, this is the Doctor kind of thing. And there was a little bit early on of like, and I think this is there, and like, I think it's a little bit in sort of Chibnall's writing, I think it's a lot in Jodie Whittaker's performance, of her being very, she's so friendly, and she's so sort of like forthright with stuff, and she's very earnest, which are, you know, traits that all the Doctors have in different quantities, but it feels sort of more emphasized in her. But like, part of that at this point starts feeling less like a deliberate character thing and more like a just natural byproduct of this Doctor only existing basically as a plot function and not as a full character. That we don't get any interiority. We don't get, you know, any sort of insight into where is the Doctor's headspace now? You know, we don't get any sense of like how this Doctor sees the world. We certainly don't get any sense of how this Doctor sees these people. And it feels like, you know, that sense you're getting of like, oh, she desperately needs these people around her. Like, there's a little bit of that in the beginning of Ractus of the UK, where she's kind of like puppy dog pouting when they're all going to leave. It's just like, oh, yeah, I'll hang out. Like, there's a little bit of that there. But generally, it feels like that trait only exists because these are our four main characters, and we need these four characters to be together because that's what that's what's been written. Like, they have to be together because it's Doctor Who. We have companions, and we decided to have three companions this time around. It doesn't feel like a legitimate character, like, storytelling choice that has been made to say, like, what is this version of the Doctor? Where is the Doctor at this point? Like, why is she, like, is she desperate to have people around her? Why is she, like, what is she like when she's alone? And there's definitely still space in the remaining four episodes to explore that stuff, but not a lot. There's not a lot of space.
And they're not going to. If they haven't done it yet, they're not going to. Like, that's exactly. It's just not part of the grammar of the show at this point. And that's what I mean by, like, as a long-term problem, that's the worst thing going on the show right now. Is that, like, companions come and go. I don't want to say they fucked up the Doctor, because Jodie Whittaker is very good, and she's great casting, and she's consistent, and you can tell when they throw her better material, she always rises to the occasion. Like, there's a moment in this episode where, like, I think she plays the scene where she realizes what the monsters are extremely well. And you pair that with last week, where she has that moment with the captain of the ship, where she realizes, oh, shit, I don't have my head on straight right now. When you throw a little curveball, I find the 13th Doctor really interesting. And maybe it's just because they throw, like, Chibnall has thrown almost no curveballs. But, like, there's those moments where it's like, there's so much more in here that has been left untapped. But we generally don't get that. The Doctor feels so dependent on the companions that it's, like, kind of hard to imagine her life outside of them, which I think is a problem. Like, most, every other Doctor, one of the things I always love is that space that you get with almost every other Doctor where you can imagine between episodes, the Doctor just went off in the TARDIS for 5 minutes and actually spent 2 centuries off in another galaxy. Right?
Like, yes.
And there is no other Doctor I can't imagine that for. I really can for any of the first 12. I can imagine there was a moment where just, like, the 11th Doctor, like, was getting ice cream with Amy, walked away, was a century in another galaxy that we'll learn about in Big Finish, and then came back for her 5 minutes later and had ice cream. And it's just like, the Doctor does that, you know? Like, Peter Capaldi, they played with that very heavily, you know?
Yeah.
Because, like, they did a lot of, like, time passing in between stuff. With Jodie Whittaker, I don't think she's existed outside of the time we've seen her. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It feels like so, just, she's, like, her existence is tied to these four humans she met 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen, like, a dialogue sequence in Doctor Who ring so false as in this episode, and there was kind of a little bit of a version of it, I think, in Arachnids and in the last episode as well. But of whenever they try to do the Doctor Who thing of like, the Doctor and companion joking around about, like, oh, that adventure we had with the space monkeys on the doo-doo planet, you know, like, that's something that happens all the time in Doctor Who, and particularly, like, modern Doctor Who likes to do that to imply adventures that, like, the Doctor and Clara had, and they did all this stuff, and to sort of show that there have been things that these characters have done off screen. And the three times they have done it with this cast of characters, I'm like, no, you did not have that adventure, because what the fuck? Like, I just can't even imagine them having a normal Doctor Who adventure. I just can't picture, like, what does Ryan do when all of a sudden he's stranded on an alien planet? I don't fucking know. Like, I don't know how he talks to people. I don't know how he reacts to those situations. I legitimately don't know why the Doctor chooses to have any of these people other than Graham with her, because Graham is the only one that feels, like, kind of exceptional in any real way. I don't mean that to be mean to Ryan and Yaz, and I like Yaz a lot in this episode, but they don't have that quality that most companions have where you can see this person is kind of extraordinary in some way that I can see why this person caught the Doctor's eye, like Bill in season 10 or something. They have a great conversation about that. And that's a big problem for me. Like you've been saying, like, I just can't quite imagine certainly what the Doctor is like on her own and like doing some other adventure, but I really can't imagine this specific cast of characters doing anything else. Like, I couldn't write a fanfic episode with this cast of characters. I just couldn't do it. I could do it with any other set of characters in the history of Doctor Who. If you just gave them to me, I could fucking start writing a fanfic episode right fucking now. I could not possibly do it with this cast of characters because I just don't know who they are other than Graham, who is my favorite. And Graham has the best stuff in this episode. He has, like, the media stuff in this episode. And like, I like Graham a lot.
Let's spend 5 seconds on Bradley Walsh. He's so good. He's been so good in all six of these. I think he's probably giving the most impressive performance of the core cast, including Jodie Whittaker, because I think he still probably has more to play. And just when you just let him light up and be human in those quiet moments, God, he's so good. He is just so natural. It very much reminds me of some of the things you would get with, like, Wilfred Mott in those episodes of Donna's grandfather. He's older, obviously. The Graham is younger, but it's just that same kind of like you don't get this a lot on Doctor Who. The Doctor is usually the person with the world-weary wisdom, and you have young people with the Doctor who don't have that yet. Graham is the guy who's got it because he's lived a life, you know? He's not old, but he's, you know, he's older than most Doctor Who characters, and he's, again, lived a life, and it's there. And I think there's moments like that. There's a moment where he is helping the fiance, the husband, get ready for the marriage, but he knows this guy might die, and he's putting, like, the wreath around him, and he's tearing up. It's so beautiful. It's so well done. And I feel like Graham is the one character on the show who consistently can get me feeling emotional through these first six episodes. And I just, if they actually fucking kill him off this season with the cancer thing, that would be the ultimate sign that Chris Chibnall has no idea what the strengths and weaknesses of his show are.
Yeah, because it's a combination of both. I think Bradley Walsh is just, like, giving an incredible performance. But Graham, like, has legitimately, consistently been given the best material in every episode. Like, even over the Doctor. Because they have kind of done, and it was sort of iffy early on when I was kind of making this comparison. I'm like, oh, it's not that much. And now I'm at this point where, like, he is straight up the Ian Chesterton of the series, of being, like, he's the real main character, it feels like to me. He is given the real biggest stuff, and the Doctor gets to do some of, like, the plot heavy lifting, and although, like, they don't give the Doctor here, like, the fun characterization that William Hartnell got to play, because there was the plot stuff was more evenly distributed in those episodes across the different TARDIS crew members. But Graham just feels like the character that's like, oh, he's kind of the lead character in a weird way. Like, he's the guy I kind of look to in most scenes. He's the guy that gets the most heavy emotional material. He's the guy that gets to sort of, like, succinctly sum up what the episode is about usually at the end. This episode is obviously shared between Yaz and Yaz's Nan. But generally speaking, he's, like, the guy who kind of gets the big stuff. And he's so good at it. Bradley Walsh just knocks it out of the park. He's both good at the really human, emotional stuff. He's also, I think, the character I find the funniest. He just, like, has a very good, solid deadpan delivery. He has a line at the beginning of this episode about how, like, this very sarcastic line about, oh, yeah, and we never go anywhere dangerous. And that was, like, the only part of that whole sequence I believed. Not the actual them referencing the other adventures, but just hitting, like, yeah, we are always getting thrown into trouble, so why should we care about that now? He sells all those moments to me so hard and is that kind of thing of, like, I want to watch the Graham show. I want to watch the show of Graham just going around all the place being, like, sort of sarcastic. And then once it gets serious, he's very deeply human and vulnerable, and it's great.
And I think it hit me harder in this episode because the human story going on around him actually mattered, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't playing off of dead air. He was playing off of something very real and genuine and impactful. And I think that's why we're talking about it this week, is because I think it actually connected in a way where, again, he's been kind of playing racquetball with a dead wall over here, you know? Like, where he's, like, throwing great serves and just there's nothing coming back at him. So I don't know what that would... I don't know what the actual version... That would be like playing racquetball with a fucking padded wall, not an actual, like, heart, you know? Like,
playing racquetball in an open field.
In an open field. That's what he's been doing. Yeah, and they never come back. And this week, it came back. And so let's talk about that main drama in the Punjab, in this moment where India is splitting up and being divided. I think it's really well done. I really like those guest characters. This feels like a focused guest cast, not just, like, you know, let's Chris Chibnall playing a game with himself of how many characters can I pack into one episode. This felt like there are two main guest characters, the two fiancés, the husband and the wife, and then there is some side people around them like the brother, but you have that main core focus. They become well-drawn characters. There is a specificity to the historical moment. What happens to them comes from a specific historical cultural moment. And it just, again, it's just, there's a general clarity to the writing we haven't had this season.
Yeah, and I think it was also smart, you know, juxtaposing this with Rosa and with and most New Who historicals. I think it's a lot smarter to do what they did in this one, where the historical setting is the setting, but it dictates what the story is, but we're not looking at a specific historical figure. We're not looking at a very specific historical event. We're looking at a broader historical event of the partitioning of India. We're not looking at like a very famous snapshot of that event. We're looking at like what the fallout of that event is and the consequences of the decisions made by the imperialistic forces in particularly England at the end of World War II. Like we're seeing that like broad historical reality played on a specific stage of fictional characters. And I think that's a much better lens to tackle this kind of topic, particularly in this format, because you don't have all the incredible pressure you have of doing a Rosa Parks episode to get all the Rosa Parks shit right. If it was an episode just set in like the Jim Crow South and dealt with racism more broadly, they would have had a lot more room to navigate that in that conversation. And that's one of the reasons why I think it works here is like, that's the setting and that's the theme, but we're able to make our specific characters and our specific situation to explore the theme we want. Because I think that setup of the sort of, you know, like bicultural marriage or however you want to phrase it of the Muslim family and the Hindu family marrying right when those countries are being split apart, that's a really powerful story. And I'm sure there's probably some historical parallels that of something like that happening around that time, but avoiding having to do a specific actual historical figure frees them up to tell that story the way they want to.
Right. It would be like if they had a character and if Rosa had gone a step farther and like Rosa was one of the companion's grandmother, you know, They didn't try to do that. I agree. And they're able to invent, but also make it specific. I think the idea of, you know, this happened because they were all forced together and they lived, you know, somewhat peacefully for a while, but now they're sort of both getting a new freedom and being torn apart. Like, it's a really interesting, it's an area of the world the show has never gone to before and never tried to tell a story like this before. It's something just in Western English language fiction I've not seen much of. I think it's a really interesting story to try to tell. It feels very authentic. I think it's extremely both moving and I think disciplined how they do the final scene with the shooting, in that it does not feel like it revels in the sadness of that. It lets it land pretty naturally. I think it uses its sci-fi element to not disguise that moment, but like to make it so you don't have to like see the thing happen, and it helps draw out the emotions of it. It's all very well done, and it's a very moving last 20 minutes, and it was an interesting sensation to be watching Doctor Who again in this form and being like, I'm feeling something again. Like, because that's the biggest problem with the other episodes. It's like, stupid plot points I can deal with, you know, if you have a bad monster design, whatever. But I gotta feel something watching this stuff, right? And yeah. I'd love to be able to feel something and have a good story. But we haven't had either of those in the last 5 episodes. This, I felt something, and I think we got a pretty good story. So that's meaningful.
Yeah, it is the frustrating thing that, like, the main stuff I feel for are for all the supporting characters. Like, or, like, not, like, because they're not really supporting characters. They're just, like, not the, like, returning cast. We're not going to see these people next week, right? Because it is, like, the marrying couple are so strong. Yaz's, Nan's mother, her great-grand-nan or whatever. I don't know how you phrase that in British English. She's a really good figure. I like her here. But then also Manish, the brother, who's like the actual villain of the episode. Like, I think he's one of the things that makes this episode work so well, because there's those couple of moments over the course of the episode where you're like, maybe this guy's going to turn it around. And there's, I think that scene where they are actually having kind of like the wedding ceremony thing, and they're back at the house and Manish shows up, and there's this moment where you're like, is he going to accept this? Because in most fiction, I feel like, and like generally speaking, that moment you're like, oh no, he's actually going to accept it. It's like Doctor Who's a family show.
Right.
And he's kind of come around on it, and then maybe he will have set something in motion that will have tragic consequences and that he will regret or something. And I like that he never turns. He never goes back. Like he had very much strikes that like strongly jingoistic figure of like this, it feels very relevant in today, unfortunately, of having this young man who is so powerfully pulled by these jingoistic forces, that he turns against his own brother, and he can't even, fuck like being like accepting the marriage. He can't even accept like the marriage so far as being able to, allow his brother to live. And that tragedy and that drama I thought was so potent, and it was so it's that kind of tension is built up so effectively that when you get to those final moments, you're like, mother, he's the Micah of this episode of Doctor Who. It's just like, fuck you, dude. Fuck off, Manish. Come on. Like, how? Like, how can you be like
but
this?
But you also feel it for all of them, including Manish, because it's like this is a – it's set against a historical backdrop where a lot of people are going to die. A lot of violence is going to happen. A lot of families are going to be torn apart. And I don't think it asks you to hate Manish. I think it asks you to feel like – this is something that happened. This was a very sadly human thing that happened, and it's a dark and horrible human thing. But it happened then, it happens now. Like, it felt like politically engaged in a way Doctor Who doesn't attempt to be much, because it doesn't, it's not about today's world. But this was both historically and, I think, present day engaged in that way. It's just really impressive use of those storytelling techniques and tools that Doctor Who has to be able to pull that off.
Yeah. It is, like, the Manish thing is also one of the areas where I feel like there was potential to have a little bit more, like, insight into the Doctor that they kind of, like, because I was really, like, looking forward to when you have that scene where the Doctor confronts Manish in the cabin and having, like, being like, okay, finally, like, the Doctor kind of gets to give her big speech and gets to do her big thing in the episode. Even if I know it's not going to ultimately work out because that guy has to die, she gets to have this moment. And I was, like, kind of disappointed by that scene because it didn't feel like it was a... It felt more like I must reveal that you actually killed the old priest guy, and it wasn't a, like, the Doctor trying to convince this guy very strongly that he's on the wrong path, and that would have been an opportunity to get more insight into the Doctor's morality, into just, like, having her feel, have a more active presence in the episode, and there's no real moment like that for her, and I was kind of disappointed by the lack of that quality to it, because it doesn't happen really anywhere in the episode. But, like, that aside, where the story really matters for, like, this story, which is, about the brothers and it's about that marriage, it nails all those elements completely.
Yes. Anything else to say about this episode? I had one thought. Segun Akinola, the composer, we have barely talked about his music. I've barely noticed it. It's been completely interchangeable and bland. I liked it in this episode.
And yeah, I thought it was better.
It might just be because it used, like, instruments accurate to that part of the world, and so it was just kind of more noticeable from that level. But I thought it tried to build themes and, like, actual melodies and stuff, and it was not just your very, very, very generic, like, 2018 movie music. So I don't think it was, like, great. It wasn't Murray Gold levels, but it was the first week where I noticed it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it worked better for this episode. I think part of it is just, like, that musical style is more calibrated for an episode like this. That is this more kind of historical drama thing. And it's not wacky zany. It's not big sci-fi adventures like most of the other ones have been. It's more subdued. And so I think just stylistically it fits better. But I also agree that I think the melodies build within this episode in a way that's effective. One other thing that has been a recurring problem in the season of Doctor Who that I think we brought up in episode 2, and I keep on meaning to bring up, and I just remember, so I'm bringing it up now. Why did they get rid of the cold open? Every single episode has had a perfect cold open structure, and instead they just start the episode with the theme song, and I just don't get why. It would be paced so much better with a fucking cold open. I just don't know why we abandoned the cold open, broadly speaking. I just feel like most shows don't do it. We have kind of brought back the idea of having an opening theme song, because opening theme songs went away for a long time in Western television. Now you kind of have them a little bit, even if they're most of them are very generic kind of slow piano songs. But we just always play them at the beginning, so I guess you can skip the intro on fucking Netflix or something. It pisses me off. Cold opens are great. They're a stylish move. I don't know. They work really well. Bring back the cold open, please.
Yeah, it depends on the show. But if you have a theme song, you should almost never, I think, start with the theme song. You should have a scene and then do the theme song. Otherwise, why have the theme song, you know? If a James Bond movie opened with the theme song, you wouldn't fucking care about the theme song. You'd need the, like, cool opening sequence where you, like, set the stage, and then you get the theme song and you're pumped about it, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just a strong... I feel like it's a really strong pacing tool, and it's weird because the episodes still feel like they are built to have a cold open.
They completely
because,
are, yes.
Every single one has, like, a, like, exact cut where, like, this is where the cold open would end, and you transition into the theme song, and they just don't do it. And it's the kind of thing, I think, particularly for episodic TV shows, they have that structure of where you need that introductory, like, 3 minutes or whatever that sets up the plot, and then you have, like, a little bit of a, ooh, what's going to happen, and then you move into the opening theme song. It's just fucking, it's just, it works so well, and I don't know why they abandoned it, and if you are going to abandon it, like, write the episode differently so that it doesn't have that weird pacing point where it feels like, okay, now we're moving into the actual episode. Let's start up the opening theme song. Oh, wait, no. We're just going to the next scene. This is weird.
All right. I want to say I'm a little excited for next week's episode because it's written by a guy named Pete McTeague, who you might not know the name, but if you buy any of the Doctor Who DVDs from the UK, these are not in the US versions, but I have a bunch of the UK ones because they're a lot cheaper than the US ones, which are mostly out of print. He's one of the guys who writes the liner notes for the Doctor Who DVD releases. He's like a lifelong Doctor Who fan, Doctor Who historian as well, writes the liner notes for some of the, like, including, like, if you got the Blu-ray recently of the Tom Baker season, he did the stuff for that, and has worked on the whole DVD range. He was a consultant for the classic Doctor Who stuff, and is writing his first Doctor Who story. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. We haven't had
I'm just glad that Chris Chibnall's not writing the next one. We have a good stretch here of different voices.
Ever in my life want to see another Chris Chibnall episode of Doctor Who, because they're fucking terrible.
Well, I've got bad news about episode 10.
I know. All right. Well, anyway, that's weeks off. Next week, we will be back, and we will probably be recording in person, Sean, because I will, if my car works, big fucking if, now that it's decided to just crap out on me in Illinois, I will be coming home for Thanksgiving to be with my family, which also means that I'll be 5 minutes away from you, and we can record a podcast and hang out, and it should be fun.
Yes, we'll have an in-person podcast. It feels bizarre to me because it feels like we just started doing remote recorded podcasts, but we have done several of these at this point, and it's like
3 months of them.
How the fuck is it already almost Thanksgiving is stressing me out tremendously.
Yeah.
Hitman 2 comes out this Tuesday, and that's fucked up.
I don't know. I'm going to be leaving town for a week, so I don't think I'm going to get it on Tuesday because I wouldn't have time to play it.
I have the digital version pre-ordered because this is a game that I want the digital version of because I'm going to be loading it up a lot and don't want to have to put the disc in.
I agree. So. I also don't know if I have the money. Again, fucking Illinois. I could buy 2 copies of Hitman 2 for this fucking ticket price. You fascist motherfuckers.
I mean, I think we now know the answer. What you need to do is you need to go to Illinois. You need to disguise yourself as a policeman. I know an easy way to do that. You just go into a bathroom in the police department, turn on the sink, wait a little bit. Someone will come and be like, what the fuck is this? And then you just knock them out. Or if it's you, you'll probably murder them with a fucking combat knife or something. Put them in a closet, put their clothes on, and then you can just go up to wherever they have, like, fucking ticket bullshit in their computer system and just go boop-a-doop-a-doop, and then you'll be fine.